Okay, Erev Tov, good evening everybody. Chodesh Tov. It was significant to me that Kislev, the month of light, is when we change the clocks and everything gets darker, but I suppose there's a bit of an irony in that. I just want to mention, as I have done in previous years, that there is a... tonight is the Erev of a memorial which, certainly for the German communities around the world, is something which will stand in infamy in for the rest of time, for the rest of history, is that the original 9/11 in Europe, the numbers are the other way around. So 9/11, the 9th of November 1938, was the night of Kristallnacht. Just for those who don't know, it was the night when essentially the whole infrastructure of German Jewry and Austrian Jewry was destroyed in one night. Every shul in both Germany and Austria was burned down. The police and fire brigades contributed by keeping the people away, that the people wanted to put out the fires. They were physically stopped from doing so. This was such an orchestrated pogrom against the Jewish community at that time. It's just beyond belief. Businesses were destroyed, etc. And I always, at this point, mention my neighbor in London, Zichrono Livracha, somebody called Felix Wolkenfeld, who... I mentioned him before. He became a chover, and those who will understand what a chover is in the German community is a very, very high honor. And he did it at the age of 16. And the reason was because at the age of 16 on Kristallnacht, he ran into the burning shul. He managed to get through a door at the back of the shul. The shul was burning down, literally. And he managed to save two Sifrei Torah on that night. His family then left Germany very soon afterwards, brought them to London. They're still being used to this very day. And that, to me, is a tremendous chizuk. It's the sense that the buildings may have gone, but the Torah continues, the sense of continuity, even under those circumstances, is really something which is very important. And I think that's something that we can think about, we can be aware of. It's a memorial which I think, as the years go on, will get less and less, because there are less and less people, essentially, who can remember those events. But nevertheless, it's important for us to, just devote, I think we can certainly devote our learning in memory of many of the people who died that night. There were so many people who were killed, so many people arrested. The Rav of the Eida Haridit in London, the Kadassia, as it's called, was arrested that night. I think he was in Dachau for 6 weeks after that. Again, they let him out, and his family went to Holland and then came to England. So, many stories, and it's just to me, it's always a very poignant time. It's a time to focus on that particular event. Okay, so we're looking at Perek Gimel, page 19 of the blue books, and page 30 of the red books. Let's talk about blue and red, without getting into sort of political discussions. The chapter 3. Probably is one of the most famous stories in the whole of Tanakh. Two of the famous stories in the whole of Tanakh. The first story is the main story is the dream or the nevuah of Shlomo HaMelech, and the second story is the famous Mishpat Shlomo, the famous judgment of Solomon. Okay, something which is quoted in so many instances, in so many places, and we will try and come to terms with what's going on there, and maybe not tonight, but certainly Mirat Hashem, I hope next week. Last week we started Perek Gimel, the first pasuk, and we saw something very strange. This is the page I've just given you. What I'm going to do is I'm going to actually read through to about the middle of the chapter, and then we'll come back to the first pasuk to try and explain what's going on. I'll start from the beginning of the chapter. V'yitchaten Shlomo. Shlomo became connected by marriage. Right, the word yitchaten, the idea of mechutanim, the idea of connecting through marriage. At Paro Melech Mitzrayim, with Paro, the king of Egypt, vayikach et bat Paro, and he literally married the daughter of Paro. Vayivel er David, he brought her to the city of David at Kaloto, livnot et beito till he finished building his house at Beit Hashem and the house of God, the temple, at Chomat Yerushalayim Saviv and the walls of Jerusalem. Basically, what's happening here is that Shlomo is following a policy which was a policy already in the ancient world, and certainly was a policy, I would say, almost up to the modern world, if not sort of part of the world today, but in a much lesser way. And that is the whole idea of political marriage. Political marriage is something where two heads of state come together through the marriage of their children or sometimes whoever it may be in order to bring the countries together. And we know of so many cases. There was the famous case of Queen Victoria who married Albert, and it was hopefully going to bring the England and Germany together. It didn't really succeed so well, because eventually there was it came to war. But the before that, there were so many examples in history. And Shlomo had a very unique perspective on all of this. Shlomo's perspective really was that in order to make the whole enterprise of building the Beit HaMikdash and making Israel strong, we saw he's got rid of the enemies from within, and now he's got to deal with the positive building of the country in so many ways, not just from in terms of the internal building of the country, which will demand both a physical and spiritual effort, but much more so the position of Israel in the world. And we spoke about this already a bit in the last couple of weeks. And here we see something which Chazal are very, to put it very bluntly, are extremely perplexed. The reality is that Shlomo here, by marrying the daughter of Paro, has, and this is the page that I gave you, the Barbanel talks about this. This is taken from the commentary of Don Yisachar Barbanel from the 1400s in Spain. And he writes about this and brings essentially three options to understand what Shlomo is doing. Is Shlomo actually going and not following one of the dictates of the Torah, which is, good evening, that you have to marry Jewish? Shlomo is in fact marrying Bat Paro, the daughter of Paro, who is not a nice Jewish girl from wherever. She's a nice non-Jewish girl from Cairo, but she's not the Jewish girl from Brooklyn. So what's going on with him? And if he is marrying her in an allowable way, there is a kind of a secondary halakhic issue of bringing converts, Geirim, from Eretz Mitzrayim into the Jewish community. There's a whole limitation there. So maybe Shlomo in this sense is being a bit, how should we say, he's being a bit premature. He's marrying her and bringing her into the fold on a much too early basis. So there's a whole discussion, which I'm going to come back to, as I said, with this page that I gave out, but I just want to see the half of the chapter we're going to deal with. First, and then we'll come back to that. So just to sort of let it stew in your mind a bit, what's going on here, the first pasuk of the chapter of Perek Gimel, and of course we mentioned last week that there is an implied criticism because Shimi was still alive. Until Shimi died, Shlomo did not marry Bat Paro. So there is an interesting kind of relationship between the death of Shimi, who was the Rebbe of Shlomo, and the fact that now Shlomo feels the Rebbe is gone, he's going to go and marry Bat Paro. So there is a sense of something which is not quite kosher, as they say. It's not quite right. Yeah.
Was it a rule about if somebody converts from Egypt, you can't marry until a third generation?
Three generations, yeah.
So in other words, no matter what he would have done, it would have been wrong.
It would have been wrong. And this is really what the Abarbanel is going to say, that he made a mistake in that particular halacha. In other words, his intentions were not necessarily of a forbidden nature, but his interpretation of the halacha was not the way it should have been. And this is really what the page is in front of you, in a nutshell, what we're going to say. But I want to show it to you in a bit more detail, because it's always interesting to see what the Abarbanel says. We're going to be doing a lot of Abarbanel in the next couple of weeks, because his commentary on this particular section of the book is remarkable. I mean, his commentary is remarkable anyway. But this particular area is phenomenal. Now, we'll just go on a little bit into the Pesukim first, and we're looking at Pasuk Beis, verse 2. Chapter 3, verse 2. Rakam mezabchim bamamot. At this point in time, the temple is not yet built, so everybody was allowed to use bamot. Bamot are private altars. All right, it's the original breakaway, not breakaway minyan, breakaway altar, but it's the same idea. You had your own thing in your backyard. And ki lo nivna bayit l'shem Hashem, the house had not yet been built for the sake of God. In other words, no temple yet. Ad hayamim ahem, until these days when Shlomo is beginning to organize this. Now, we know that there is this sense of private worship going on. And what happened as a result? Pasuk Gimel. V'ahav Shlomo et Hashem lo lechet b'chukot David avim. Shlomo loved God to follow the statutes of David. Rak ba'bamot u'mezabech u'maktir. Only difference being that he brought offerings on bamot. Again, he was part of the crowd or leading the crowd, and they would all use these bamot. There were certain periods of time when these altars were forbidden. At this point in time, seemingly we have to say they were allowed. There was a certain period during the period of what's known as the Givon period, when the tabernacle was in Givon, which, those you know, Yerushalayim is literally just past Ramot. It's not very far from the center of Jerusalem today, certainly. And this is where one of the larger Bamot was situated. So Shlomo, this is where he used to do his korbanot. And he's, again, remember, he's not very old. According to what we said last time, he was around 12, 13 years old. The Barbanel says, no, he must have been a bit older. He argues against that. He says he must have been at 20. So he's 20 years old, whatever. So Posek Dala, Vayelech HaMelech Givono, Lizbach Sham. That's very interesting. If you think back to what David HaMelech did, that famous story when he took the ark up to Yerushalayim, and he's dancing like crazy. Mefazez, mecharkeh, all those expressions that is used over there. And remember, Michal was very upset with him because she felt this was undignified behavior. You know, you're royalty. You don't behave like this, right? The royal we. And she was really upset with what David was doing, the way he was jumping around and dancing and doing all his thing. And of course, at that point, there is this disconnect between David and Michal. Now that's back in Shmuel Ben. What we have over here is that Shlomo HaMelech, it says over here, is going to Givon. He's going to the Mishkan. So it's interesting. David was going to Yerushalayim, to the Oren, right? Which is where the Oren was now being taken. Now, this is where it is at this point. But Shlomo is still going back to the Mishkan. There is a kind of different, how should we say, literally a different derech, a different path for the two men. David is already going straight, as far as he's concerned, the Oren and Yerushalayim represents, if not the physical temple that is not yet built, but it represents God's presence in Yerushalayim. For Shlomo HaMelech, it's not yet built. So Shlomo is already someone who is much more concerned with the bricks and mortar. Seemingly, he is more concerned with the, let's call it the material side of things, than he is with what we would understand the spiritual side of things. Now, why am I saying all this? Because this is a very, very important point. Rav Aryeh, one of the writers today in Eretz Yisrael, he writes about this. And he says that you have to understand, I've mentioned this before, you have to understand that Shlomo and David had two very different approaches to God. David, as we've seen again and again and again, was someone who looked from above. It's a ruta de la ela, the Gemara calls it. It's an expression which is used in Talmud, used in Kabbalah. The idea of hitorut, to be, as it were, inspired from above. And David was always looking for that inspiration from God. David was such a godly person, without going back over all the ground that we've gone over. The reality is that he wrote the book of Tehillim. And look at every Tehillim. It's all about the relationship to God. God, get me out of this situation. Get me out of that situation. And closely, you know, Odechol, we read it all this morning in Hala. All of these wonderful ideas, which is clearly David's expression of his closeness to Hashem. So that's David HaMelech. We know this from many examples. Shlomo is a different kettle of fish. He is someone who's going to come along, and he is saying, I suppose I understand this in a way, because, you know, what you think to yourself, you know, he's clearly intelligent and he knows what he's doing. Is he just going to follow blindly the way of his father, particularly if he doesn't feel that is his inspiration? And the answer is no, he's not going to go in that direction. He's decided that he is going to do what is called, the classic terminology for it is, it's aruta dilatata. He wants to elevate everything from the ground up. And it's so interesting that he feels that he wants to make the connection to God through material existence, through building, through everything that he does. As you'll see in a minute. Yeah.
So the Mishkan was built in Givon.
Yeah.
But the Aron was
in Yerushalayim.
So what was left to see Mishkan without?
Without the Aron, yeah, yeah. But there was a Mizbeach. There was an altar there.
The altar
was there. So the altar was something. And again, it fits the description of Shlomo to go to the altar and to do his korbanot. David would immediately say, I want to go to the Oron and do my praises of God. Because there's no altar there. There's no facility to do korbanot in Yerushalayim as yet. Seemingly they didn't use bamot in Yerushalayim. That might be a point of discussion. I'm not sure. But reality is that where was the great bamah at the moment? The great altar in Givon. All right. Now Givon to Yerushalayim, as I said, is not that far, but it's clearly two distinct locations. And all of this is going to be unified. Shlomo is going to bring, obviously, Givon to Yerushalayim. He's going to unify the two elements, and of course, Jerusalem will then become the focus. But this hasn't happened yet. Okay, it's just fascinating what Shlomo is doing. Yeah.
Corollary to what you're saying is there could not possibly be a Bodhisattva in the time of David, but you could see the roots of it in the time of
Shlomo. And this is going to be the big challenge. Shlomo is walking in a very dangerous minefield. It's the minefield, believe it or not, we all walk through every single day as Jews in the real world. Right, there is the ideal circumstance, if you think it's ideal, and some of us will think it's ideal, of being absolutely cut off from the real world, living in within a circumstance or within a community or within an area where we hope we can keep out all of the influences which are negative. Okay, call it Mesh Arim, call it Coney Island Avenue. I'm not sure if Coney is the same, but whatever. Something of that mindset, where everything of the outside world can be supposedly kept at bay. And of course, that's a solution for many, many people today who want to kind of emulate, I suppose, in a way, the David HaMelech approach of getting closer to God in the most spiritual way possible. And if you can achieve that, that's phenomenal. It's like Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. Everybody says people try to emulate Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai in his approach, which is very similar to what we're talking about. And it says very, very few people succeeded. Most people failed. The other approach, which I think is what Shlomo represents, is that we've got to take the material world, the Taken Olam Machut Shakai. We've got to take the world and repair it. We've got to make the world a better place. We've got to make the world a stronger place. More awareness of God in the world that we live. Be it in our workplace, be it in the way that we conduct ourselves in the street, be it in the way that we interact with the non-Jewish world. It's more fraught with dangers, obviously, because the influences are so strong. And even if we not think we're influenced, the fact is we're very influenced. There's no question about it. But at the same time, if we can maintain standards and elevate the material world into something spiritual, we are achieving a phenomenal thing. I just heard a shiur today, and essentially this is what the message was to Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov was going back, as it were, to daven at Yerushalayim. He says, we're going to sleep there, and he had this tremendous dream. And the dream was saying to him, essentially, there's a ladder from heaven to earth. You've got to bring heaven in connection with earth. You've got to connect the Rosh HaShemayim, but Raglo Al HaAretz. You've got to have the sense that, you know, you're connecting the two worlds. Not just divorcing yourself from Eretz, but you're actually doing something with it and making it a holier place. So without going into all of those ramifications, it's interesting, going back to the text, that Shlomo represents a completely different approach to God. And I want you to be aware of this, because this pasuk that we have over here, pasuk Dalet, is very significant. Verse 4, Vayelech HaMelech Givono Lizboach Sham, the king goes to offer up offerings in Givon. Kihi habama gdola, that's the big place, that's the ultimate altar that exists. And what does he do? Elef olot yaleh Shlomo. We've got no idea what that means. In other words, the number, 1,000 animals in one shot is just beyond our understanding. Alam is beachahu on that altar. And the Gemara says something very powerful. The Gemara says that, you know what, on the one hand I've got 1,000 offerings of Shlomo, and I've got one Tehillim from David HaMelech. How does it weigh up? The Gemara tries to give you a balance. And the Chazal say that in the name of God, that I prefer the one Tehillim of Shlomo than the of David than the 1,000 korbanot, the 1,000 sacrifices of Shlomo. In other words, in terms of looking at it from Hashem's perspective, obviously somebody like David with one Tehillim, one chapter of Tehillim, can achieve a tremendous height which maybe Shlomo will never achieve in his life. But you know something, that's looking at it, I suppose, from the top down. But what Shlomo is trying to achieve here is a sense of beginning a process of making the material world a bit holier. And I say all of this because when you read the description of the Beit HaMikdash, one of the things that really strikes you is the attention to detail. You know, you would expect it to be a very simple place. You would expect it to be kind of without the frills. But you know something, when you look at it, and you realize, for instance, that Shlomo had to get gold to overlay the whole of the inside of the temple was overlaid with gold. So when you walked into a room that didn't have wallpaper, it had gold leaf all over the place. I mean, it just it just really is amazing. And you'll say to me, what has that got to do with relating to God? This seems to be, you know, like this is the craziest shul you've ever been to. This is where you've got not just marble on the floor, you've got marble everywhere. You know, people have gone crazy. The answer is no. For Shlomo Amel, it's exactly what he's the message he's trying to to get out there, is that you've got to take the material world and you've got to elevate it. You've got to make it holy. And this is what Shlomo does now with his 1,000 olot, with his 1,000 offerings. And this is going to be Shlomo all the way through. And of course, the danger is, as we know, that the outside world does have its influence on Shlomo, and eventually it's overpowering. He pushes envelopes here so far away from the line that they should be on, or should the area they should represent, that in the end things become very, very bad, as we'll see in due course. But listen to this. I just want to do a few more psukim, and then I want to go back to this page. Posuk hey, b'givon nira Hashem el Shlomo b'chalom alayla. At this point, Shlomo goes to sleep, and he has a vision from God. And there's a whole discussion, was this a prophecy? Did Shlomo achieve nevuah? He's very young. And whatever you say about this, the majority of the Mefarshim say, no, it was a chalom. It was a dream conveying a message. V'yom elukim sha'al ma'atein lach, the famous story, God says, what do you want? Ask whatever you want. V'yom el Shlomo, and Shlomo said, "Ata asita im avcha David avi chesed gadol. God, you did such a great kindness with my father. Kasher halach lefanecha beemet tzedaka b'yishuat leivav bima. My father went before you in righteousness, and Yosha Lev is given a mention, everything about him. Vatishmolo et achesed agadol hazeh, and you should keep this kindness. But you guarded for him such a kind. In other words, you treated him in such a kind way." And you put his son on the throne today. In other words, you know, I'm grateful, Hashem, for everything that you've done for me till this very moment. Hashem, O Lord, my God. This is all happening in his dream. You made me the king instead of David, my father. I am a young lad. And that's what Rashi says, Yud Beit Shana. You see the Rashi over here, Nar Katan, Ben Yud Beit Shana Haya. I'm not going to go through the Rashi. Rashi does the whole calculation that he works out that Shlomo is 12 years old at this time. He hasn't even done his bar mitzvah yet. But whatever. Lo Eidat Seit Vavo. He says, I'm a little child. I don't really know the comings and goings. In other words, I haven't had experience in life yet. And you're saying to me, you know, what do I want? But however, listen to this. Your servant is in the midst of your people. I am amongst the Jewish people. Am Rav, a large people, who cannot be counted because of the large numbers. At this point, the whole country was mushrooming, things were developing, things were growing. So what does he ask for? He says, I'm asking for a Lev Shomer. I love that expression. It's not just a heart to understand, it's a heart that listens. To listen, to be able to hear not just the argument of the other person. I think he's saying, I want to listen to the feelings, I want to listen to the emotion, I want to listen to the pain. Don't even just want to listen to what they're saying, I want to be able to sense what's going on inside the people who come before me. Because he knows as a king he's going to be judging who knows how many different sort of situations and disputes and whatever, and he wants to have Lev Shomer. This is an unbelievable expression here. A heart which listens. Okay, you say that the Ozen Shomer, your ear listens, but Shomer in the sense, not just to listen, but to understand. Shema Yisrael, the idea of understanding. The idea of coming to a deeper awareness of what the people around me really are about. And this is a very, very amazing request. And he says, this is what I would like, Lishpot et Amcha, to judge the people, Havin Bein Tov L'Ra, to understand, to be able to distinguish between good and evil. Ki mi yuchal lishpot et amcha b'kaved hazeh? Who is able to judge your people, this heavy nation? All right, or some say this great nation, but I think kaved can also be in the sense of heavy. You know, being the rov is not so easy. Being the king must have been impossible. And the reality is that we're going to have to judge. And of course, what happens at this point, v'yitava davar b'nei Hashem, the thing was very good in the eyes of God, ki sha'al shlomot davar zeh, that Shlomo had asked for this particular matter. He'd asked for this sense of chokhmah, this sense of wisdom. V'yom elokim elof, so God said to him, Yan asher sha'alta et adavar hazeh, lo sha'altcha yamim rabim. You could have asked for other things. You could have asked for long life. All right, the fact is, according to tradition, Shlomo died either at the age of 52, most people accept, or as I said, the Abarbanel gives him a few more years. But whatever it was, he died maybe around the age of 60, which is not very old. And you didn't ask for long life. You could have asked, you know, you could have won the lottery. You could have got as much riches as you would have wanted. I gave you a blank check, and that's what you could have got. Or you didn't ask for the soul of your enemy. In other words, to win your battles, just to hand over your enemies. All you want to be able to do is to understand, to come to a deeper awareness of judgment. God promises him all in the dream that I will do as you say. You'll have a wise, understanding heart. Never had anything like this beforehand. After you, there will never be anything like you. And of course, the Mefarshim say, what about Moshe Rabbeinu? Was in fact Shlomo greater than Moshe? Lo kam ka Moshe od, we say this every Friday night. There's been nobody like Moshe since. The answer is that in certain aspects of wisdom, Shlomo seems to have been greater. The reality was that overall, Moshe clearly was a greater human being. He went up to Shemayim. He lived there for 40 days, 40 nights without eating. We don't know how that's possible, but that's what he did. Shlomo didn't do this. But at the same time, we know that Shlomo had an awareness of what is called Chochmat HaTeva. Talk a bit about his wisdom in a second, because it's really important to understand that there is obviously, as I said, the Shlomo HaMelech, the Shloimele, the Rup Shlomo, the idea that Shlomo is has got this tremendous wisdom of Torah, which he had, and which clearly is reflected in much of what he said. But there's also going to be an element of Chochmah, what the Gemara calls, or what the rabbis call Chochmat HaTeva. He has an amazing awareness of the world around him. All right, there's a wonderful Rashi, which I just got to share with you in a second, which just blows my mind. It's a scene from a movie that I remember with Eddie Murphy, Lahavdil. I think I just have to say Lahavdil about that, if you know who I mean. It's when he, I think they did a series of movies, he plays Dr. Doolittle. And I think the first movie, he actually wakes up one day and starts hearing the animals and starts getting out of his mind. They're all having conversations, and it's a very funny movie, but, you know, it's kind of a mythical figure in a way. Shlomo HaMelech was the real deal. He wakes up after this dream, and all of a sudden, the whole world is talking. The trees are talking, and the birds are talking, and, you know, it must have been overwhelming. And look what it says here, Yud Gimel. This is still God's promise to him. V'gam asher lo sha'alta natati lach. In other words, whatever you did not ask for, I'm going to give you anyway, because you got the right answer, what you asked for. Gam osher, you'll be rich. Gam kovod, you'll be honored. Asher lo ayah kamocha ish b'melochim. Kol yomecha, nobody will be as great as King Shlomo, as a melech. However, the condition is, if you go in my ways, nishmoch ukai mitzvotai, to keep the Torah, kasher alach David avich, as David did, your father, ve'arachti et yomecha, you'll have a long life. Ve'ikat Shlomo v'inei chalom. Interesting, because we have that expression by Parah, right? You know, it was a dream. You wake up, you're startled, okay? Ve'yavoy Yerushalayim, and of course, at this point, he doesn't go back to Givon. And staying in Givon, he now realizes he's got to go to Jerusalem. He's got to make that kesher, that connection. Now he goes to the Oran. But at that moment, what does he do? Again, this is Shlomo HaMelech's derech. He's not going to stand there and zog a kapitel to heal him, no. He must have made him his mizbeach. Maybe there was there already. We spoke about that before. Clearly there was. And at that point, he has to make even more sacrifices. And he makes a phenomenal party for everybody. This is, a lot of people say, this is a remez for the idea of making a party when you finish learning something, or Simchas Torah, all different sort of remozim here. I just want to show you this Rashi. This Rashi blows my mind. Vayikat Shlomo, Pasuk Tet Vav. If you're with me, the Rashi, those have the red books, page 35. And it's the Rashi Tet Vav. Vayikat Shlomo, Vinei chalom, it was a dream. What does it mean, hinei chalom? Hinei is a sense of surprise. What was the surprise? And this always amuses me. Vinei hevin shechalomo emet. The surprise was that the dream was true. How did he know? Shomea of mitzafsef. He heard the birds chirping. Umevin l'shono. And all of a sudden he understood what they were saying. The kelev novech, he heard the dog barking. I'd love to be able to understand Millie. One day, you know, it'd be a wonderful thing to do. And what does he say? Umevit l'shono. And he understood exactly what the dog wanted. So, you know, he wakes up. The whole world has completely changed. Now, how he didn't go out of his mind, I really don't know. Because in the movie, if you remember, you know, Eddie Murphy has a breakdown over this at the beginning till he realizes that he can use it for a proper purpose. The whole story of Dr. Doolittle. But in this case, Shlomo, he knew that all of this was true because it happened to him straight away. He had Lev Shomei, he had this idea that he could actually listen, hear and understand not just the concept of the people around him, but even the animal world. Even it says he could talk to the trees, as you say, in Yiddish, Meretzim Vant, and he could even talk to the wall possibly as well, who knows. Unbelievable, just unbelievable. I just want to go back a little bit to what we said, as I said at the beginning, and this is the page that I hope some of you can sort of see. If there's still some pages to give out. The whole question of Shlomo's marriages, because this is going to be a serious topic, and I just want to do a little bit of the Abarbanel over here, just to sort of enlighten you a bit. One of the things about the Abarbanel's commentary on Sefer Melachim, which is so unique, is that he doesn't, how should we say, he doesn't cover over things. He's not in the business of trying to explain away things. He comes from a background. Abarbanel himself was a man of the Spanish court, and he saw things in court in the malchut, in the majesty of Spain, and what was going on, which he writes about in his commentary on the Book of Kings. Because so much of what is expressed over here, he understood because he lived it. He was there. He saw how these people behave. You know, and this is something which, again, is very difficult. You know, I come from a country where the greatest honor in the world, probably for anyone in England, is to get honored by the Queen. You know, if you actually get called in, then it's a whole performance. You bring your family, and you have to get a special suit and a top hat, and the whole works. It's an unbelievable thing, and it's an honor beyond belief. And this is something which I think Abarbanel understands, which is why I want to follow a lot of what he says, or give you a taste at least of what he says, because it's so precious. He really does understand what's going on here. So he's dealing over here with the marriages of Shlomo. We said that Shlomo, the first thing he does in order to start building the enterprise of the new kingdom of Israel, is to marry, make political marriages. He ends up marrying 700 wives from all over the Middle East and 300 concubines and who knows where they came from. And, you know, Shlomo was unbelievable. And that, as I said, we're going to say for another time, the whole idea of what Shlomo did with the verses in the Torah. The Torah talks about limited wives and limited horses and not having too much money. And Shlomo seems to have gone completely berserk in every way against that, but we'll come to all of that in due course. Have a look at this page that I gave you, and I'm sorry about the size of the print. I tried to increase it a bit. Vayitchaten Shlomo, just to look a bit at section A, and I'm going to sort of jump you around a bit down to section B, and you'll see C on the other side, and just to take a little taster of what the Abarbanel talks about here. But let's just set up the problem. Vayitchaten Shlomo got married. Achareish Zachar. So the Abarbanel says that once it's mentioned, Shlomo gets rid of all the problems in his own kingdom. From the enemies within. Remember, he got rid of Shimei, and he got rid of Yoav. You know, all these guys are gone. Zochar she'asa'od eize sheini latmid lahachin malchuto. Now he's got to establish his kingdom in a second way. Bashlimo ubitchadno in paro melech Mitzrayim. The first enemy you've got to deal with. And it's so interesting that the first peace treaty in our generation, which has been so significant in Israel, however cold the peace is the one with Egypt. So Egypt has always been the power that we've got to try and make peace with if we want peace in the Middle East. That was something remarkable. And he says that to do this, he's got to go to Pharaoh. Shayam Melech Gadol v'Yakarov Elon. Very close. It's the nearest potential enemy. V'yasah zeh k'dei sh'yeh imo b'shalom v'avah rabah. And he does it in such a way that he'll be at peace with Egypt. Fine. That's why it's not just he's marrying the daughter of Pharaoh, he's really marrying Pharaoh. Because the reality is that he wants Pharaoh to be a member of the family, his father-in-law, and he won't start with him. He'll have, you know, it's the Shver, but at least he'll be able to deal with him, hopefully, in a positive way. Because Pharaoh is the great king of Egypt. He has this connection through marriage. Initially, not because of her. It's because of her father. Now, this is where it gets interesting. However, אם חטא שלמה בזה אם לא, והיא שאלה הרביעית אשר שאלתי פרשה. He always sets up his questions at the beginning, and the fourth question he asked was Shlomo sinning by marrying the daughter of Pharaoh? אם הייתי נמשך בזה כפי סברה ישרה בפשט הכתובים, if I just look at the obvious meaning of the verses that we just read, הייתי אומר שלמה לא חטא כלל, שלא היה אותו חיתון אסור. I would immediately suggest it wasn't forbidden, because the fact is that as soon as it says he got married to Bat Paro, it immediately says after that that Shlomo went in the ways of God. All right, now if we're talking about a forbidden marriage, how could it then say in Pasuk Gimel, V'ahav Shlomo et Hashem lelechet b'chukot David? Shlomo loved God to follow the ways of David. If this marriage was forbidden, that is mentioned in verse 1, then verse 3 of the chapter that we just read would really not be correct. Yeah. Correct. And this is what we're going to say. Hang on a sec. This is what the Abavanel does. He does not want to cover over the problem. So listen to the next paragraph. And I'll just do a little bit of this. He says, Hayiti machriya, it's underlined, Shelo chata Shlomo ha-melech klal b'lachot bat paro li'isha. I would say, my initial reaction is to say, there's no sin involved in marrying bat paro. V'yamnam, the safek ha-shlishi asher eroti, still I've asked the question about the marriage, kamosha omar achrei zev ha-melech Shlomo ahav nashim nachriyot rabot, ve'et bat paro v'gom, it says in chapter 11, that the king loved all these foreign women, לא אשימו כתוב שמה על התחתנותו בהם. He's not blamed for marrying them. כי אם על אשר אהב אותם, this is the point that Abe made, it's the question that he loved them. בחשק נמרץ, with a certain amount of zeal. He was over generous with the fact of his attention towards them. לא כאדם לשתוק, not like a normal marriage, he says, כי אם באהבה מופלגת, this was over and above kederech hanarim lebetulot, like the way the young men run after the young ladies. It's so interesting when he writes it. You know, he puts it on the line. V'zeu omro hav nashim nachriot ved bat paro maviot amoniot, etc., etc. He loved all these women. So what is being said over here is that the actual marriage may not necessarily have been anything particularly forbidden at the time. We have to understand why not, because obviously he's marrying a non-Jewish woman. But he says the big issue at this point in time, the beginning of Shlomo's kingdom, was the fact that he was putting so much zeal into the relationships that he was having here, that it was almost as if, you know, he was indulging himself. And of course, this is back to what we said before, that the danger of Shlomo's derech is that the material world becomes a place of indulgence. If you are living in, as they say, the lap of luxury as a king of Israel, king of anywhere, then the fact is, and we know this from history, so many of the kings became so self-indulgent about the fact that they would just sort of follow their own pleasures, that they lost perspective. Now Shlomo doesn't do this at this stage, clearly not, but the danger is already there. And the reason why this has to be said is because we'll think back to this in a few weeks' time, or maybe sort of after the Christmas break, the Hanukkah, it won't be Hanukkah break, it'll be here Hanukkah, after whatever break it is in the winter, whatever you want to call it, yeshiva break, after that break, we'll come back to this, because we're going to have to explain Shlomo's behavior in chapter 11 of Malachim, where in fact the women do influence him very, very badly. Just look at, get further down the page at what he... Yeah.
Where is his wisdom?
Well, his wisdom is going to be in his brain, but it's not going to be in his heart, right? What we're going to see, initially we're going to see an incredible exhibition of chokhmah like you've never seen in your life. Certainly chokhmah in terms of teva, all right? You look in Chazal, you'll find chokhmah in terms of Torah. Learn Sefer Mishlei with the commentary of the Vilna Gaon, you'll see tremendous connections and wisdom, etc., etc. But there's no question about it that Shlomo represents the ultimate dilemma of intellect versus emotions. And it's the classic Musa problem, right? The Bali Musa talk about this the whole time. How can you affect your mind to be influenced by your heart and not the other way around? And what Shlomo is doing at the moment, seemingly, is beginning to play a very dangerous game. His dangerous game is that he's allowing, as it were, his wisdom to almost get to the point where he feels he can cope with any challenge, with any temptation. And you know something? This is going to be very much an eye-opener for us. Shlomo is not a person, let's say, who is very simple, who is very, almost David, you can say, is simple to understand in the sense that, you know, he's up there with Hashem the whole time. Shlomo's not like that. Shlomo's a person who clearly is bound by the materialism that he's in and trying to elevate it, but at the same time, it's affecting him. And already we're seeing the word ahav. Shlomo, it says, he loved these women to the point where seemingly he became a bit indulgent with them, and that's already a sign of the influence that the world is having on him. So where is his great wisdom? The answer is that, you know, it's not being shown in this particular relationship.
I think you can blame David, too.
What
David, what other kingdom do we have that went and killed a man so he could take his wife.
Now, again, are you going to say... That's true. And of course, the whole example with the issue with David's behavior with Bathsheba is a very serious issue in terms of Shlomo's existence, because, you know, this is where he's coming from. But it's clear by the time that Shlomo is born, and certainly by the time he comes to Malchut, that doesn't affect him. I don't think that affects him as much as the policies which he decides to put into action. Now, where does that come from? That comes from a sense of chokhmah. That comes from a sense of knowing intuitively how to be a melech, how to be a king in the Middle East of those days. I don't think the issue is about the background. It is certainly with Adonio, and it's certainly with Avshalom and everybody else. With Shlomo, no, he's got different issues. His issue is essentially, how is he going to connect the people to God, where he sees everyone is living in a very materialistic sense, and he wants them to connect to something very spiritual, very holy. How do I make that bridge? That is Shlomo's biggest challenge and his biggest issue, and unfortunately becomes also his biggest downfall. He doesn't succeed where he tries to succeed, and this becomes a big challenge for him. So I'm going to argue
but
that...
But he felt he was above everybody else, because he did everything he wanted to do.
Yes, absolutely. Of course, the book of Kohelet, traditionally written by Shlomo, tells you exactly everything that he tried. Hevel Avolim. In the end, he realizes it's all a waste of time. But remember, he was right at the beginning. So let's give him a bit of time to sort of sow his oats, as they say, and then we'll get further.
Can you answer how it is that he married someone who wasn't Jewish?
Yeah, we're going to answer in a second. Look at the bottom here, section B. And I've got to finish this. Well, hang on a second. According to what it said, look at the bottom here where it's got B at the side of the page, if you have it, Chazal. Underline just the last four lines. Aval Chacham, so the Barbanel doesn't see in terms of Shlomo's behavior, as far as he's concerned, he does mention that, and the previous underlining, the third line of the underlining, the Fisha Gaira, V'tavla V'chnisa Tachat Kamvei Shechina, that he did convert the daughter of Paro before he married her, so she was converted. Doesn't say so in the Pasuk, but that becomes the traditional acceptance of the way that he would marry her from the point of view of the rabbiner. Otherwise, he's going to have the rabbiner on his head the whole time. You can imagine. Sorry? And it's there. But look at what he brings at the bottom here, in the last underlining on the right-hand side. Aval chachameinu zal kiblu amitata mitzvata toriot, asher zachartu b'ofen acher. The rabbis say something else. Omru Yisrael shabal goya derech ishut, o Yisraelit shenival goya derech ishut, loki min haTorah. The first thing is that if you have a relationship between a Jew and a non-Jew, you've broken a negative precept of the Torah. Shenema, and he brings the pasuk. You just look on the other side of the page, on the left-hand column, and where he says at the top here, Hinei Hariticha. I've cut out a lot of his commentaries. I just had to. Very, very long. Hinei Hariticha Derech HaChamein Ezav Binyan Hazeh Mekubal V'Amiti. In other words, as far as Chazal are concerned, they have a doubt whether he actually converted these Bat Paro and all the other women. They throw a question of doubt into the whole story. And what the Abarbanel says, which is section C, which is the underlining about 10 lines down, Aval l'da'ati be'emet ze shogeg haya b'dva alacha. What the Abarbanel is going to suggest is that, you know what? Shlomo actually made a mistake when he married her in a halachic issue. And what's the halachic issue? He says, Shechashav Shacharei Shegiara, because after he converted her, which is what we have to say, and it's brought in many, many, as you said, Metzudas and the Rambam brings it, Lo haya alav Asham, Lo haya alav Asham, yeah, there was no guilt on what he did, Vaita muterid lo. After he converted her, he thought she was mutter, she was allowed straight away. But Siruf Lezer, Shelo nitchaten imah ki im lashlim malchuto. He's only doing it to make his kingdom stronger anyway. Ba'avu paro melech Mitzrayim, so to have a connection with Pharaoh. Sheyah karov elav kamo she'amarti, lo me'avad bito. Not out of love, but he's doing it out of political considerations. V'liyot kavanato retsuya kasher. It's getting smaller as I'm reading this. Kasher lacha. So we have to say, you know what? By marrying her, he really is still following God. He's got a whole thing. I'll just go down to the next underlining. What he's basically saying is that, you know what? Shlomo, in the end, made a mistake that you have to wait a number of generations before you really can marry this woman. And he was in a position where he thought, as soon as he has gone through, or she has taken a swim in the River Jordan, or wherever she went, the reality was, he thought she was allowed to him straight away. And therefore, what the Abarbanel says is that Shlomo, in fact, did something here which is called Beshogeg. He inadvertently married her when really he should have been more aware of the fact that the halakha was not as free with for him as he thought it was. So what the Barbana is actually suggesting is that in this marriage, as much as there is this tradition that they were converted, and all of the wives were converted somehow, again, all took a swim in the river, I guess. You know, they did as kind of mikveh, but what knowledge they had is almost probably zero. But the reality is that the Barbana wants to say that Shlomo's marriage had within it the potential for a negative outcome. He was doing something which halachically was very questionable. All right? I mean, he says shogeg, shogag. He actually did something for shogeg. This would be something that Yom Kippur he'd have to do alchen, you know, he'd have to do teshuva for this, which we're not clear whether he really repented from this. Yeah?
It seems as if, like, from this story and from the story where David answered, he was running away and he had a question on Nida.
Yeah.
As you said.
Yeah, Abigail.
Like, they didn't go to a, there was no such thing as a rav.
Yeah.
And they didn't go to ask a shalom from a kohen gadol.
Yeah.
It's whatever they thought themselves, whatever they...
Because that was the status of Melech.
Yeah. No. Is that how they decide halakhic questions?
No. They did have the concept of certainly of Sanhedrin, because that's mentioned many times. And they would know the halacha, but not always. You know, there are certain situations of Sanhedrin throughout the generations who made tremendous mistakes. The classic one is Yiftach. Yiftach and the Sanhedrin, they made a horrendous error. All right, in terms of, they thought that the vow of Yiftach was not negotiable. And the fact is, it was negotiable. And look what happened in the end. According to the Mefarshim, he killed her. All right, at least she was put into some sort of solitary existence, whatever it was. Terrible, terrible outcome. So the reality is that with all the existence of Sanhedrin, of these courts, their ability to get it right all the time was not necessary. It was necessary. It wasn't necessarily the way it was. If you're learning the Daf Yomi, we're struggling with a Gemara called Hariot. Hariot is all about where the Beis Din makes a mistake. And this whole Gemara is like 14 pages, unbelievable Gemara, so difficult. And the concept is incredibly difficult. Because, you know, we have this idea of infallibility. It's come into our religion from another place. We're not infallible. We never have suggested we ever were infallible. We never will be infallible. We will make mistakes. And the Gemara is the greatest example of teaching us, what do you do when you make a mistake? They're based in Paskins and they got it wrong, and how do you then rectify with Korbanot, etc., etc. So I think this is something that we have to appreciate over here as well. That at this point in time, Shlomo may have been very full of his own sense of knowledge, of wisdom, Chochmah, right? And however you want to understand the word Chochmah, Chochmah Torah, Chochmah of Teva, whatever knowledge. I mean, he's now speaking to the squirrels running across the road. Whatever conversation he's having with them. So the reality is that, you know, something, there may have been again an issue of humility. He didn't take it to the right channels. He just decided it for himself. Was there a rov around? No. Shimi was dead. Shimi was his rebbe. If he'd gone to Shimi, he would never have done this. Shimi would have said, Shlomo, you know that Shteitan Posuk. So this is not Teresh Baal Peh, it's Teresh Bichtav. Right? Shteitan Posuk.
He said early on, he waited till he died.
And he waited till he died.
The point is, he must have known.
It was controversial. Let's put it that. That's why the Abarbanel says, you know what? With converting her, there is still an issue. Shogag. there was a shogeg, at least a shogeg. Right? He doesn't want to say amazed. The Chazal want to put into, you know, a really negative light the whole thing, because they don't give Shlomo the benefit of the doubt in this case. Whereas the Barbanel says, you know, allowing for that tradition, I'm going to kind of make a shidduch between the two ideas. You're absolutely right. And it's unbelievable. It is unbelievable. It comes as a bit of a shock, all of this. Yes, Jack.
I think the beauty of this whole thing, this whole controversy, is to show that in Yiddishkeit, we will always believe that we can't make anybody a deity.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
Everybody is human.
Everybody's human. And that is comes out. What if that's...
As opposed to other religions.
Correct. Oh. Correct. And of course, that's one of the great lessons of learning Tanakh. Is that we understand that as great as these people were, they also had human faults. And we are learning about them in order to grow from this. Right? It's phenomenal. And Shlomo is going to be one of the, in a way, more extreme than David ever was. Because David, as I said, was up in the clouds. And when he came down to earth, he came down to earth with a bump because he couldn't really handle coming down to earth. You know, David was up there with God. But Shlomo is a guy who's living in the immaterial world. He's the Wall Street executive. He has it, you know, he has all the degrees. He has all the knowledge. He's been to Columbia. He's got all the Doctor of Science degrees you could ever imagine in your life. And at the same time, he's been in Lakewood for 25 years, so he knows all of that stuff. And he's done everything. And he's got it all rolled into this one individual. And you know what? It's not a great combination. It's going to produce a lot of problems, a lot of issues. And what I'm going to say, just again, this page is certainly worth looking at. I'm sort of trying to encourage the Barbanel. The problem is that Art Scroll have never translated it, and I don't think they ever will, because it's just too controversial. The Barbanel says really shocking things, very interesting things. But I'm trying to sort of get a bit more of awareness of this, because Barbanel is very, very interesting, very challenging when he... deals with these subjects. What I would say for next week, of course, is please read through the Mishpat Shlomo, the famous story of the women who came to Shlomo with the baby, because that's a story that everybody knows. We're going to try and sort of be a bit original about it and ask the following question. And the basic question we're going to try and deal with is, why did Shlomo not actually apply Jewish law in this case? There is a very clear halacha which Shlomo could have applied, and he didn't. Motzi mechavero v'raya. There's a halacha which is all over Gemara. It's all over Talmud. It's like possession is 9/10 of the law, and that's it. So why did Shlomo bring the whole story with the knife and with the performance that he made? There is something, there's a different agenda here in what's going on in this famous Mishpat Shlomo. And of course, that I think will again be part of what we're trying to say. We're trying to build a picture of a person who is faced with this tremendous dilemma. On the one hand, he's Shlomo. He's got the Jewish traditions. He's aware of all of this. He comes from the house of David, for goodness sake. On the other hand, he's trying to be Melech. He's trying to be the king. He's trying to bring Israel into the big world. He'll stand up in front of the United Nations and he won't be afraid to say what has to be said. And if the Iranians he disagrees with, he'll tell them, you've got to do something about this. We're not going to sit around and wait for Iran to do, God forbid, whatever they're doing. You know, he's tough. Shlomo would have said what needed to be said. And he'll do what needs to be done. This is Shlomo. But at the same time, he's got this kind of conflict, as I've suggested before, and is coming out even stronger here, between his kind of, the side of him which is very spiritual and the side of him which is clearly very material. And how he works all through all of this is going to be one of the great insights into Shlomo HaMelech, which I hope will certainly interest everybody, continue to interest you, please God, in the coming weeks. Thank you for listening. Shlomo, again, according to tradition, 12, according to Rashi. Barbanel says he was more likely to be 20. The way Rashi works out the chronology, if you look at the Rashi, Abarbanel disagrees with that. But he says he wasn't older than around 20 years old. So he's still very young.
He was a cotton.
Cotton. He was still cotton over here. So what he was when he got appointed was even younger. You know, we're talking about the Yingle.
No, I understand that, but to get married as a cotton.
Yeah, okay, but that in those days, the kings are kings. You know, the French kings used to marry the kids off and almost from the crib. I mean, it was unbelievable. You read the history of the monarchies, you know, political marriages were just outrageous sometimes. But it's all part of what Shlomo is trying to create. Okay, and this is something very fascinating. We're going to have to maybe restructure our thoughts about Shlomo HaMelech. Not a bad thing to do, but something very worthwhile. Thank you, everybody. Mitzvah Shem, continue next week.